Like a swarm of ice bats bursting forth from the frost hollow, screeching out discordance at the establishment. Wrecking havoc across the voxways of the Underhive, we are the true sound of rebellion, 665.66 UHMR Chemrat Radio. Coming to you live tonight from Mama Kaz's Noodle House.
Not gonna lie, fellas, the ramen here is still at least 5 out of 5 toilets, if not lots. And speaking of lots, the Corridor 54 killer has struck again, leaving 7 skinned and strung up bodies in the ruins of the Lex Orin weapons manufactorum. At this rate, I'm not sure what's going to happen first. They get caught, or they get their own Voxcast show.
Hey, at least ramen's fresh.
And the snow stopped.
I don't know if that's snow, Chuck.
Never backing us into a corner because he couldn't even find a corner if we gave him a map. It's Marky.
Hello, motherfucker.
Freezing hearts just as fast as he warms up the ladies. It's the polar bear of the Frost Hollow himself, Sugarfly.
Hello there. How you all doing tonight?
Goddamn sexual Tyrannosaurus. You can hear his mating call from miles away.
And soaking up as much of that radioactive neon as I can, I am your host, Goblin King.
Hello, everyone.
Wait, did you just hello everyone for me?
No, that was you. I mean, that was Tom. That was Beast.
I'm outsourcing now. This is perfect. I love this.
I'm lost now.
I don't know what's going on. Welcome to episode 78 of Under the Hive of Madness. This is the Great Crusade Part 3. Originally, we had planned to make this series a 3-episode run, but the deeper that we have dug into it, we've realized that there is just a lot to cover. And to do it justice, we kind of are going to need to take a little bit more time with it. It probably won't. I mean, it'll end up being a part 4, but it'll be one of those like part 3.5s because we'll talk probably a little bit, like half of the episode will be wrapping up the Great Crusade, and then we'll probably dip into kind of some of our ideas and things that we would like to see expanded and stuff like that, because this episode is planned out to get almost through all of it, but there's some really big events, and if we rushed over them, it would really undercut their importance, and it would really undercut their impact on the way that the 41st millennium is. So we don't want to do that. We don't want to kind of like half explore an idea or give you guys a footnote for something that has like a 3-novel series. We want to give you a little bit of juice when there's that much content and that much lore behind it. So bear with us. Our aim is to explore the lore in a way that helps make sense and actually explain things and leaves hopefully less questions than when you were introduced to a lore topic.
Yeah, kind of like a Jackass 4.5, right?
Yeah, with and our planning is about as good.
Yeah. It's like the big semen monster terrorizing the city.
Oh my god. That's dude. What we're gonna talk and that's actually what Ryan's about to talk about.
Yeah. In fact, the big semen monster that terrorized an entire city. Yeah. That's one way to sum up the Night Lords. I don't know if there it's the go. Proper way, but it's a way.
I really needed the backstory on that bit. I really needed it. Really needed to understand where all that semen came from.
Did you though?
Conrad Kurz, baby.
No. It's just he's been saving it in like ketchup packets.
Oh god. He's got them strapped to his chest like a shotgun. Like shotgun shells.
Oh my god. Wow. Dude.
When you act bad, he replaces your ketchup packets with the real ones.
So for those of you who are not following us on Patreon, if you join us on Patreon for $3, $6, or $9, not only do you get a little bit of a glimpse behind the red curtain, so to speak, and see a little bit of our planning sessions and kind of what we talk about before we start recording, but you also get to see our lovely faces, and Chuck is motioning to his entire body and Chuck's entire body. Or at least his upper torso. And we also have a bunch of pictures that correspond to the episode. But to give you guys that are just normal podcast listeners, podcast listeners, a little bit of an extra glimpse into kind of what goes on. We do plan out and lay out episodes about a year ahead of time. Like, we know what we're going to be doing roughly for about a year. And then based on that, that's right. We actually have like 2 years at this point, but based on that, we're flexible. If we get a guest or, you know, a community spotlight or something, that somebody who wants to come in, somebody that reaches out to us or somebody that we really wanted to talk to, we get an opportunity to talk to them. We move our schedule around and we're flexible. In a lot of ways, we do kind of break the episodes down into like into series, essentially. You know, when we talk about a faction, we split that faction into several different episodes. We call those like faction series or faction breakdowns. And when we look at big events like the Great Crusade, we're going to do the Heresy. I know we're going to do the Badab War. We got a couple of other big major events that we're going to cover. We do the same thing. We kind of, we split it. We write a template or what's the word that I use? Treatment. That's the word I'm looking for. We write a treatment, or I write a treatment, and I run it by these guys, and we basically make sure that we're all kind of on the same page, and then I do the research and fill it out. And sometimes we set out a goal of like, we're going to cover the Great Crusade in 3 episodes. We're going to cover the Heresy in 3 episodes. And then as we kind of get into it, we kind of figure out, even though in a treatment it looks like we can do it, we can't do it. And then I
come out of left field and I make the podcast entirely about things that don't matter. Like this. Ryan, you need a nickname.
For what?
Because Chuck is the goddamn sexual tyrannosaurus.
I have a nickname. It's Goblin King.
I self-proclaim myself as sex machine.
Ryan, the Goblin King.
No. A real nickname.
He means that is a real sex nickname.
He needs
Have you not seen Labyrinth with David Bowie? I am the Goblin King. Do I need to bring up a picture of David Bowie as the Goblin King in those type fucking leather? I'll do it. I'm doing it.
Like Bojangles.
I'm doing it. No. Doing it right now.
It's not sexual enough, Ryan. You can't double Gabo.
I mean,
what?
How about we just call him Jairus?
Have you not seen these skin tight pants with that?
Yeah, I have.
With that
have.
Bulge.
I've seen the GIF too.
Wait. There you go. I figured it out. The bulge.
The bulge. Yes.
There you go.
Yes. I like there you it. Go. The goddamn sexual tyrannosaurus. Okay,
why did we need
sex
these
machine
things?
In the bulge? That's right.
This is the battle of
the bulge.
This is our late night radio personalities. When we're on SiriusXM, these are our names.
Lock up your daughters and shoot your sons. Love Fist is coming to town. We got the goddamn sexual tyrannosaurus. Sex machine. Hello, and the Battle of the Bulge. That's right. We got it down. We're good.
All right, we can move on now.
All right,
hey, done. Thanks everybody for coming. That was a good time.
And now the Great Crusade is 5 episodes. Thanks, Marky. Yep.
That's exactly the point. And this is why we spread out to 4, possibly 5 episodes of the Great Crusade.
Because of the bulge, we had to spread.
That's right. It does it unknowingly.
I do that. I have to. I make things spread. I'm sorry.
There's a word for it. What's it called when you like
spreading lore all over town?
That's right. Goddamn semen monster. What's that shit called when like you do that? Your body does it automatically, like breathing, for example, or like
automatic response.
Yeah.
The bulge spreads as an automatic response.
Exactly. Ryan knew exactly what I was talking about. Thank you, Ryan.
You're right. The bulge the bulge sometimes just needs a little bit more room.
Moving on to the semen monster. Conrad Kurz.
So I like this. I like this fake band that we're coming up with, but we need a name other than like as fitting as Love Fist is, it's from GTA Vice City, so we need another band name.
Sump Love.
Sump Love. Sump Fist.
Sump Fist is coming to town.
Oh, I love it. That's fucking great.
All right, so starting off episode 3.
Lock up your four-armed rats and shoot your hive gangers. Sump Love is coming to town.
Oh my god.
We're starting the next episode like shit. That, man. We're starting the next episode like that.
You gotta remind me, because by then I'll have forgotten.
Me too.
The purveyors of sex metal.
Fuck metal.
Fuck metal.
Fuck metal. All right, get it right, Chuck.
Grindcore, come on.
Let me grab my bulge so I can get my high pitch going.
Bulgecore.
Bulgecore. Oh, yeah.
It's always like gotta be a secondary sex characteristic, so it feels super naughty, but like at the same time, older people, we are older people, but older people won't get it.
Yes.
Did you say bulge cord?
Bulge core. Like core. Metal core, oh. But core.
Yeah.
That's right, bulge core. I love it.
So that means I have to go buy all the minis now with musical instruments.
Yep, 100%.
100%.
We need to buy three, what do you call them, goth rockers, and that's how we do it. And then Ryan just has this humongous cock piece. It's
cod.
Just, cod? It's not cod?
It's not cock. It's called a cod piece.
My bad.
Again, they had to be close, but not on the money.
Damn it. My buddies in football lied to me. One of the coach looked at me weird every time I said it.
So speaking of fake heavy metal musicians, we're going to start off today's episode with the destruction of Nostromo in 984. I thought that was going to be funnier to you guys. I'm really sad. Do I need to try again?
I thought last week was funny with the destruction with that religious city. So
Monarchia. Well, no, yeah.
The word bears.
Yeah.
There is no character. Okay. So you guys, now I'm explaining the joke, which makes it less funny. You guys know what Deathlock is, right? Metalocalypse, yes. Deathlock. So Conrad totally makes me think of, I forgot his name.
The lead singer again?
Napalm Disaster, or whatever the lead singer of Deathlock's name is. God damn it. Why is my brain failing me?
I do not know the band name, band members' names, but yes.
Lead singer of Deathlock's name is... Oh, come on. Just tell me. Well, I know it's Brandon Smalls. I know the actual guy. What's the character, you fucking dumb internet thing?
Google has failed us.
Well, it's not telling me the fictional names. It's telling me the real. So it's giving me the real.
We saw his search engine the other day. So
Nathan Explosion. That's his name. Not Napalm. Nathan Explosion. There is no character. You know what Nathan Explosion looks like, right?
Yeah.
Okay. There is no that Nathan Explosion and Conrad Cruz are like cut from the same fucking cloth, man.
Have you ever seen Bat Metal?
Yes.
Ryan?
Yes. That's Deathlock's music.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. When he teabags the criminal in the alley, the back alley, and the other dude pretends to be dead. He's like, I don't want to get fucking bulge slammed by Batman right now.
Bulge. The bulge again.
All right. Got to circle back to it.
It's moving swiftly into the destruction of Nostromo. We're really not the podcast that gets right to the subject at all. hopefully everybody takes the beginning of the podcast to like go get a drink, maybe walk the dog.
I need to go empty my paint cup.
Yeah.
Check in on their children, make sure that no one's murdering each other. Like you got at least 10, 15 minutes of us being inane bastards before it starts.
Mandatory podcast fuck around time.
That's right. That's right.
Brought to you by Sump Fist.
So we are going to start off with the destruction of Nostromo in 984.m30. Before we get into the destruction, though, let's talk a little bit about Nostromo itself. This was a hive world that was enshrouded in a perpetual night or a perpetual darkness and acted as the former home world for the Night Lord's Legion and their Primarch, Conrad Kurz. Conrad, better known as the Night Hunt.
Sorry.
I kept thinking as I was doing the Conrad research, I'm like, I am Batman.
Either of those work.
It's true. It's true. So Conrad, better known as the Night Haunter, a name he preferred was an incredibly tortured soul, plagued his entire life by terrible dark visions of the future, which led to a psychic anguish and despair, which set him apart from all of the other Primarchs. He was also a brutal warrior who believed that terror tactics and fear were the most potent weapons that could be brought against one's foes. He also did not enjoy his role as a leader in the Imperial War Machine and as one of the Primarchs, and he showed little to no affection for any of his sons, the Space Marines of the 8th Legion, which were created from his genetic template. This was not a happy, well-adjusted dude in any way, shape, or form.
No, not at all.
And the world he came from, for its part, was just as fucking black and bleak. Nostromo had been rich in adamantine, and the mining and refining of the metal became its primary export, leading to massive amounts of polluted cloud cover and smog. When this was combined with the planet's orbit around its slowly dying sun, it led to a dark and incredibly bleak atmosphere, where noon was barely brighter than midnight, and only the richest of the high spires of the hives could afford dim blue lumistrips.
This sounds like the fourth member of Sump Fist.
100. It's our lead singer.
This is our lead singer. Okay.
We need somebody to...
God, Conrad Kurz.
Or maybe the dude that goes forward with the lead guitarist. That's what it is.
We can't have the lead guitarist with the first name of Conrad. I'm sorry. He's got to, like... Cockpiece Cruise.
Cockpiece Cruise.
That's our lead guitarist. The fourth member of Sump Fist. Lock up your four-armed rats and shoot your hive gangers. Yeah, I was going to say Sump Gangers.
I don't know how those are different, but those are a little different.
Different enough.
Nostromo was also a world of extremes, with the lowest of the low living in abject poverty and the highest of the high living lives of incredible luxury. And because of this, it was a world where crime absolutely flourished, at least until Conrad became its ruler. While he was by and large an efficient and benevolent dictator, Kurz became the Night Haunter through his brutality, having murdered and mutilated thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. From petty criminals to the corrupt aristocrats who had ruled before he chose to rose to power.
He got tired of it.
Yeah, he got tired of it. And even the smallest crime, like, was punishable by death. He would fucking mutilate bodies and leave them in the street.
So you're saying he's like another comic book character, but chose the path of murder.
Yeah, he's like Batman, except he chose murder. In a lot of ways. Nostromo and Conrad's story is much, much deeper, and it will get its own deep dive. But just bear in mind that this guy became a good leader, in air quotes, through sheer terror and absolute brutality. When Conrad joined the Emperor and left on the Great Crusade, some of the fear and pressure that he had left on the world seemed to lift. But even with the Imperial Administratum left in place to rule the planet, it was not long before the crime and corruption of its past once again rose to prominence. For his part in the crusade itself, Conrad was seen as erratic and became a source of suspicion among the other Primarchs, and he never really ever meshed well with the group of them. He always kind of stood apart. He also still suffered from visions, and these often came with like epileptic-style seizures. And in these visions, he would see his own death. He would see his legion fighting an endless war against other Astartes legions. And despite the concerns that some of his brothers showed for him and because of his conditions, he isolated. He didn't open up to them. He removed himself more and more and more from the situation. However, this broke at a point, and he finally had to confide in Fulgrim. This was the brother that he felt closest to. He shared his nightmarish visions of Astartes fighting Astartes. Conrad even shared a vision he had of the Emperor killing him and of the Emperor destroying Nostromo. Not knowing how to help Cruz, Fulgrim turned to Dorne, and this only made it much, much worse. Dorne became incredibly angry with Conrad, and he saw these visions that the Night Haunter was having as attempting to basically talk shit about the Emperor. Dorne didn't really believe it. He was like, this is Conrad spreading lies, you know, being diversive, etc. Because of this, Dorne confronted Conrad. And while little is known of what took place during this confrontation, Dorne was later found severely wounded, surrounded by Conrad's personal bodyguard, who had been slaughtered to a man. And the Night Haunter himself was gone on his way to return to Nostromo with his legion. This is the first fight between Primarchs. Conrad and Dorne had it out. It's very obvious that Dorne murdered Conrad's bodyguard, and Conrad left Dorne hurt.
Good old Cockpiece Kurz.
Yeah, I don't know if you're going to touch on it later, but I know in the novels, Kurz is the only Primarch. Dorne was, I wouldn't say feared, but...
worried about.
Worried about in hand-to-hand combat. He's the only one. I was like, you know what? This is not a guaranteed win.
Yeah.
Horace and everybody else, I got him. This one,
a little bit of a badass.
When we
look at that regal motherfucker.
When we talk about Conrad, so when Conrad gets his episode and we talk about Conrad and Nostromo in a lot more detail, we'll talk, we'll probably circle back in more detail to the fight that he had with Dorne. But in this episode, we're kind of like that.
Just real quick.
That hint of it is what you get. But again, like this is that he severely, and no one else has severely wounded Dorne. He did.
That's how you look in the band, by the way, Chuck. You're just covered in gold.
I'm fucking fine with it.
Yeah. No, no pants. Just a gold, like a gold upper torso.
A gold lame upper bodysuit. Yeah.
Sexual tyrannosaurus.
And a gold leaf. A large gold leaf. What's a big leaf, Ryan?
Oh, like an olive leaf over his junk?
Yeah, but we need something bigger than that.
I don't think there are leaves, like an elephant ear.
Is that a real?
That's a big ass leaf. Yeah, it's a big ass leaf. A
golden elephant ear.
Yeah, and a golden elephant ear.
We named that my guitar, the golden elephant ear.
Jesus Christ.
That's the only thing covering his goddamn, what the hell's the word? His decency?
His girthy man hammer.
That's right. His girthy Dorn. What's Dorn's hammer called?
It's called the fist of Dorne.
Yeah. It's called the girthy hammer of the Imperium. What are you talking about?
That's right. Is it really called the fist of Dorne?
Yeah, Lysandre wields it.
Man, how are you going to call your weapon? You can call your weapon after yourself.
It probably wasn't named the fist of Dorne until after Dorne disappeared.
Yeah, it was probably originally named my Warhammer.
Yeah, it probably didn't have a name. It was probably just the thing that
Fetch
he used.
Fetch my Warhammer.
Fetch my golden girthy hammer.
Fetch my elephant leaf.
The golden girthy hammer. That's the name of Zax.
Cruz would fulfill one of his visions himself. For upon seeing the planet had returned to its criminal and corrupt ways, he bombarded the world with orbital fire until the crust cracked. This destabilized the world's core and the planet shattered into drifting remains. Cruz saw this as the rightful and just punishment for how Nostromo had been allowed to run in his absence. He didn't give the planet a chance to explain itself. He didn't allow the Administratum officers or anybody that was from the Imperium to escape. He just fucking destroyed his own planet. For this crime, Conrad and the Night Lords were recalled to Terra to face judgment at the hands of the Emperor. However, they would never make it back to the throne world, for the seeds of the heresy had already been planted. Horus had started to plot the coming rebellion, and having never felt at home or at peace in the Emperor's realms, the Eighth Legion and their Primarch would join with the War Master. We're giving dates, but remember all of this is happening kind of within a range. So Cruz is called back to Terra after he destroys the planet, after the Imperium finds out he destroyed the planet. So even if he destroyed it in, you know, 9984.m30, that's when he destroyed it. That's when all of these events kicked off. The news that he did it may not have arrived to Terra for like 2 or 3 years. And within those 2 or 3 years, Conrad was probably already on another battlefield. And then at that point, he's told by the Emperor, finish your job and come back to Terra. And then he finishes whatever he's doing and he gets ready to head back to Terra or whatever. But then another battle happens and he gets delayed or whatever. By the time Conrad had a chance to return to the Emperor, to return to Terra, it was too late. The language kind of goes back and forth like that. I know that you've asked this question in the past, Marky, because this is so overlapped with each other. There's a lot of these like, it was too late. But technically in 984, it wasn't too late. It's just by the time the wheels of the bureaucracy hit, it was too late. There's a really long-winded way to explain by the time the bureaucracy caught up with him. It was too late. It
takes a long time for sound to travel in space.
The message could take 9 months to reach. And then at that point, he's involved in a 2-year campaign. And then it's going to be 6 years to travel from that campaign back to Terra or whatever.
Sounds like a challenge for some fist.
So the Istvan system is first brought into Imperial compliance in 994.m30. The Istvan system was odd for being one that had many worlds within it that all existed within the tolerance for human inhabitation. Not only that, but the system's worlds also contained signs of a past Xenos occupying force, and had a lot of flora and fauna that were shared across the planets with lots of similarities. You've got four or five-ish habitable planets. They all have dinosaurs on them. They all have deer, bears. They all have dinosaurs. And it's one of those things that, like, makes you scratch your head a little bit. All of these signs pointed to these worlds as having been the site of ancient Xenos terraforming activity. By the time the system was brought into compliance during the Great Crusade, Istvan III supported a thriving human population, a population that had thrived throughout the Age of Strife and had overbuilt the ancient Xenos civilization that had once occupied the world. Istvan V, the other important world that we'll come back to in this system, on the other hand, had been rendered barren Terran millennia earlier. It was tectonically instable and plagued by rampant volcanism, although it still could technically support life. The world was crisscrossed with signs of an ancient Xenos occupying force. The ruins of roadways, waterways, dams, and other vital infrastructure spanned the continents of the world, as well as the empty shells and remnants of macro fortifications. These macro fortifications had been built by molecularly dense artificial stone. They consisted of massive towers and huge fortresses and rebouts. What is that word? Rebout?
It looks like redoubts.
Redoubt? I know it's a fortification, but how do you say it?
I've actually never heard of that as a fortification, a redoubt.
It's like an old way of talking about.
I see it all the time in the novels. I don't know how to say
it. I believe it's
a
like
bunker.
It's like an earthenwork bunker. Yeah, essentially. Yeah, right. Bunker. So anyway, there are all these bunkers and towers and different fortifications.
Redoubt.
Redoubt? At some point, redoubt.
Check it out.
Redoubt.
Redoubt. Got it. Thank you, lady.
Why don't you type in Ketchikan?
So, no, quotation, don't do that.
See how
don't,
it says
no,
it.
No, stop. So basically, there were all of these big fortresses, redoubts, you know, all of these towers and everything that were very obviously built by technology and very obviously held technology at one point. But by the time the Imperium got there, none of that, it was all gone. Everything was gone. Istvan V only had the barest signs of floral life, hardy plants adapted to live in its volcanic wasteland. So it did have oxygen, it did have water, it did support humans without wearing masks. It just wasn't comfortable at all.
It's just like, you know, being in a desert with a stream.
Yeah. Are you giving us a definition to read out?
Oh, it said some kind of fortification.
A temporary or supplemental fortification, typically square or polygonal without flanking defenses. Oh, it's one of the, I know exactly what it is. It's the things that we loved building back in the day. Like, you know, like all the star fortresses and stuff.
Kinda. They're like those bunkers from D-Day?
No. Older, like these things.
Oh, okay.
Like they're all like pentagon shaped and like, yeah. Okay. That's a redoubt. Cool. It's a weird word because I'm like, redoubt? Like I'm reading out something? Or do I doubt that it exists? Redoubt? It probably has something to do with like, because you can never get an angle on attacking it, maybe. Maybe that's the root of the word.
Yeah, it's not like it's re, like redoubt.
Right. My brain wants to redoubt it.
Yeah, definitely looks how it's spelled.
Redoubt that it ever existed. The pacification of Arc Reach Secundus, 999.m30. The Arc Reach cluster was discovered by the 47th Expeditionary Fleet led by the Word Bearers. This area was unified under an alliance that covered a huge chunk of worlds throughout the area. And when this alliance refused to join the Imperium, the Word Bearers were let loose. And this is the Word Bearers after they've been censured by the Emperor. So they are back on the brutality level. They are no longer on the, like, we're going to approach it because we want to rebuild it. They are 100% in loose cannon, murder everything. Rage. Based on how large the area was, the Space Wolves and the Thousand Suns were brought in to support the Word Bearers. Heliosa, bearing the Imperial designation Arc Reach Secundus, became the last holdout in the subsector, and as a result suffered the combined assault of three legions and their Primarchs. It has to be a shitty situation. Not only are you the last planet and everybody's fled to you, but then three fucking legions and three Primarchs all land, I would give up. I'd be like, I'm done, guys.
It's okay. Heliosa.
Thank you.
No. It's
Harry. Wow.
I know what you're doing. Thank you. Thank you, Hermione.
Anytime.
You would think at that point, though, with the three Primarchs that are there, one's already on a murder rampage all the time. The other one's proving himself now.
Yep.
Yeah. It's like they're there just to kill.
Yep. When the king of Heliosa realized defeat was inevitable, he attempted to surrender, but Leman Russ refused him and put the entire stronghold to the slaughter. The Space Wolves then drove those to be slaughtered before them and burned everything they left in their wake. When the Thousand Sons attempted to preserve the planet's great library, the Space Wolves and Thousand Sons came to blows, and a bitter, if short-lived, skirmish followed, during which Russ almost killed Magnus, condemning his brother as nothing but a filthy sorcerer. However, the two were stopped by Lorgar. A year after the planet was brought into compliance, it was subjugated to an exterminatus at the hands of the Wordbearers, and we don't know why. Came back and they blew it out. Fucking airlock.
Just cause.
For those of you out there who are keeping count or score, Conrad and Doran had an all-out fight where one of them almost died. Now Russ and Magnus have had an all-out fight. While widespread conflict hasn't happened yet, we already start to see the Astartes fighting other Astartes forces. This is well before what the Imperium considers the beginning of the heresy. All of the cracks, all of these heavy personalities working in close proximity, all of that shit has started to fray.
It's a little fucked, man. You like surrender and they're like, nah.
And
I ain't hear no bell.
Yeah.
But it's Leman saying it, which is bad.
I got a theory why the word bearers came back. Sacrifices.
For the Emperor, right?
No. Not at this point. A year later.
At this point, Logar has already the pilgrimage of Logar is already done. Logar has already accepted the primordial truth.
Yep.
Forearmed Emperor.
Yeah, he's blood for the...
Yeah, Forearmed Emperor.
Yeah, blood for the Forearmed Emperor.
So you're telling me Magnus was a bitch?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a little hard to, like, kind of differentiate that shit because they were all ridiculously powerful, but they were all ridiculously powerful when they were using their own form of combat. Or in comparison to Astartes.
Yeah, like, when everyone's all powerful,
nobody's
all powerful.
Right, exactly. So it's just one of those things. Like Leman, there were a couple that were at the top. There were a couple that were definitely the ones you didn't want to fight. Leman was up there. Kurz was up there. Logar was kind of known, was not really known that much for his fighting. Horus was up there. Horus was another one that nobody really ever wanted to like get into a knockout fight with. Sanguinius was known. Yeah, Angron. Sanguinius was known as a master swordsman. Fulgrim was known as a master swordsman. But like, it's one of those things where it's that thing, you know, that every once in a while, there was a whole show on fucking Discovery Channel at one point of like,
all the different warriors.
Yeah. What if the Navy SEALs took on the Apache Commandos from the American Indian War, and then they tried to break it down.
I always liked those.
They were always fun, but it's that type of bout. Like, you know, if Magnus was using unrestrained sorcery against Leman, would Leman have been the victor? Probably not. Using unrestrained sorcery against his brother? Probably not.
Didn't Horus use Sanguinius as like a sheath? Spoiler alert. He was a master sheath.
God damn, that's cold, Marky.
Man.
That's pretty funny. I'm gonna keep my claws inside of you. You don't mind, do you?
he used it for a sump fist sheath.
That's when metal really starts to hit.
that's when bulge core comes in.
That's right.
The triumph.
It's a mixture of fuck metal and... And what's the normal hive?
We've got synth.
It's like thrash or something like that.
Yeah, thrash or something. Yeah. We've got like four different ones.
Well, no, there's like a legit one, right? The normal like hive.
No, music. Thrash. It's just called thrash. Like the official one that's in books is just called thrash.
Or it's a mix of fuck metal and thrash.
Maybe it's thrum. It's something like that, though.
Yeah, thumb? It's some thrum. It's got a weird, like, little one-word thing. Yeah.
All right. Next up, we had the Triumph of Ulinor in 000.M31. Right up top, we discussed whether or not Ulinor was going to get its full episode right here in the middle of the series back when we were planning it, as the planet and its conflicts touch on most of Warhammer 40K. Since the planet has so much to do with the Imperium and with the orcs, but we'll probably be dedicating a planet spotlight to Ulinor. We already did a planet spotlight on Armageddon. It'll be a little confusing. We'll probably do either a planet spotlight on Ulinor or a focus on the Ulinor Crusade itself. However, we're going to cover it briefly now, and we want you to remember this is the planet that was eventually stolen by the Adeptus Mechanicus, moved to another part of the galaxy, and renamed Armageddon.
Did we do a, what the hell are they called? I hate my brain sometimes. Did we do an asteroid belt spotlight on Cadia?
No, we haven't done planet spotlight Cadia yet.
But it's not a planet, it's an asteroid belt.
We're going to do a planet spotlight on Cadia right after our planet spotlight Alderaan. That was just to piss off Patrick. I got to bring up some Star Wars shit just to piss off Patrick.
There we go.
I'm just kidding, Patrick. When we do Planet Spotlight, Alderaan will bring you on. It's fine. The Ulinor Crusade was a massive Imperial assault on the Orc Empire of Overlord Urlok Urg, which took place during the Great Crusade. Ulinor Prime was the capital world of Urlok's Empire and was the site of its final assault. This crusade, within the crusade, saw the deployment of 100,000 Space Marines, 8 million Imperial Army troops, and 600 starships of the Imperialis Armada. This marked one of the highest points of coordination and cooperation during the Great Crusade, showing just how awe-inspiringly powerful the might of the Imperium could be. This conflict marked the largest concentration of orcs ever faced by the Imperium, and would only be overshadowed by the War of the Beast in M32, and then the Third War of Armageddon in M41. So there are three massive conflicts with the orcs, and they are in order. The biggest was the Third War of Armageddon. The second was the War of the Beast. And the third was the Ulinor Crusade. Horus, who is already seen as a strategic genius, even among the other Primarchs, devised a plan that became famous and synonymous with the Luna Wolves. The spearhead attack aimed to destroy the enemy, in this case, the Orc Wa, by removing its head and letting the body infight and destroy itself. The White Scars and Ultramarines attacked the outer worlds of the Orc Empire in a decoy tactic meant to draw the majority of the Orc forces away from Ulinor Prime itself. Then the Luna Wolves launched their attack on Ulinor Prime, which had been left pretty vulnerable. The entire Luna Wolves Legion, 2 million Imperial Army troops, and 100 titans of the Collegica Titanica were led by the Emperor himself in the assault that had been planned by Horus. The orcs outnumbered the Imperial forces 5-1, but the strategy was not to take them on as a whole. The Emperor and Horus, backed by the Luna Wolves, clove a bloody path directly towards Urlok Urg and his retinue of Orc Knobs and Augrins. But this was interesting. This was an empire that was formed by orcs and Augrins. There were Augrins in it.
That's awesome.
The Digginobs.
Probably.
Yeah, that's why the Emperor wants all the mutants killed.
Urlok's fortress was bombarded by drop pods and heavy gunships, which shredded the fortress defenses. Then Horus teleported directly to the base of Urlok's central keep, accompanied by the entire strength of the first company Terminators of his legion. The majority of the Terminators held off the orcs, while Horus and 10 Terminators of the Justiarian squad, led by First Captain Ezekiel Abaddon, rushed the orc warlord. Horus and Urlok fought in single combat, while around them, the 10 Terminators, led by Abaddon, crashed with 40 of the largest knobs recorded to date by the Imperium. Horus and Urlok ended up fighting as if alone, outside of the throne room, on the summit of the tower, so they basically fought out onto the balcony. Eventually, the Primarch bested the enormous orc, picked him up, and heaved him two-handed from the parapets of the tower. The screaming and flailing orc warlord met his demise as he splattered almost half a mile below in the fortress courtyard. This dude just fucking orc just right in the middle of his troops.
It was like, Horus? what's his name from Lord of the Rings, Chuck?
Yeah, exactly. Belrog?
No, not Belrog, yep. The other guy.
Gandalf?
The guy that fell off the
guy
king.
Who gets thrown off the tower.
He like jumps off because he's on fire.
Son of a bitch.
Oh, did I get you?
This is not a Lord of the Rings podcast, Mark.
Dinamore? Is it Dinamore?
It's not a fuck metal podcast either, but here we are.
It's not a fuck metal
That's true.
Podcast.
That's true.
Yeah, Boromir's father.
Yes.
That guy.
Dinamore, something like that.
Throws himself off the.
Yep.
Throws himself
while he's
off
on
of
fire because he tried to light Faramir on fire.
Ran a football field on fire.
Gandalf kicked him off, and yeah, all that good stuff.
Horus returned to the throne room to find all of the orcs and all of the Terminators dead, save for one. The gore and viscera covered Abaddon stood atop a mountain of orc knob corpses. Leaderless, the orcs fell into infighting, even as they were still being assaulted by the Imperial forces, and the battle on Olinor Prime became a massacre.
So it worked. Cut the head off and it ate itself.
And that became Horus's and the Luna Wolves and Abaddon's like signature move. Abaddon and the Justiarian were really well known for that.
Abaddon rock bottoming an orc war boss. Off the top rope.
Oh no, that was Horus that threw the.
It was Horus.
Oh, it was Horus.
Horus threw him. Yeah.
Abaddon was the only Terminator who survived the fight inside the throne room.
Yeah, with the magic of editing, Horus rock bottoming the orc war boss from the top rope.
I like how Marky thinks I'm going to edit that.
I just it's so cool though, that whole scene. It's like the largest knobs recorded to date. Or no, recorded ever.
Yeah.
So how massive is that?
That's pretty big.
The knobs in the War of the Beast may have been bigger. It's one of those like recorded to date at the time.
At the time.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
And that's pretty consistent with orcs. Like every time a big orc conflict comes out, there's slightly bigger ones. But the War of the Beast will get its own focus, and I'm sure we'll at that point talk a little bit more about Olinor and the Olinor Crusades effects and how it led to the War of the Beast. It's important to remember, and we'll kind of cover this as we talk about a couple of more conflicts that happen in the Heresy, but there are several like little campaigns and little crusades that happen after Olinor that are just like the White Scars chasing down an orc war boss that followed Urlok that made a new Wog. It happens like twice. That was how many orcs were gathered in one place. This was a massive orc empire.
Empire, yeah.
As we covered in the last episode, this conflict ended with the Emperor naming Horus Warmaster and announcing his return to Terra to start his next great project. This was the secretive human webway project that he didn't let anybody know about. While cracks have already been spreading with conflicts between the Primarchs themselves and the issues with the Night Lords and the Word Bearers specifically, this moment, the naming of Horus as Warmaster, is often seen as the first major step toward the Heresy. I would argue pretty largely that the actual first step is the burning of Monarchia, the raising of Monarchia. Logar turning for the Emperor is the actual first step, but
I will agree with that. That's the first hardcore step because they turn to chaos right away.
That's right.
Yeah. You guys know, like Fred Flintstone when he does the tiptoe like bowling move.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's how the Horus Heresy is, right? So it starts with the tiptoes and then it finally gets to that one step that you guys are talking about.
Yeah, there's lots of little things that are happening here and there. And it's set up relatively well because you get all of these intertangled personal conflicts between the Primarchs. You start to see the fraying of even the Astartes. You know, these guys are on the field with each other. And part of it is because the expeditionary fleets, that the Crusade was split up into several expeditionary fleets. And we've named a couple by name. And as these expeditionary fleets went out, they were essentially alone. So you might have an expeditionary fleet that is 50,000 ultramarines supported by 40,000 Imperial Army troops and two Titans. And they're off fighting on their own in their own part of the galaxy. And then some major conflict happens and they're brought back into the fold. Horus or the Emperor, somebody says, hey, we need help. You know, you guys are closest, come back. This is a 200-year conflict. So they come back with their, like, 5 to 10-year personalized trauma and experience, and then and fighting style and all of that. And then they have to fight alongside a group of people that have a completely different set of battlefield trauma and experience. And there's infighting. And a lot of times these early infighting episodes are things like the Thousand Sons wanted to save the Great Library on Heliosa, as Hermione reminded us. But the Space Wolves are like, nah, fuck it. We're burning everything. Fuck these guys. We're burning all their fuck entire it. Culture to the ground.
Yeah, fuck it. Burn it.
And that's all it takes to put these two powers and these two Primarchs at each other's throats. It's that minor of a conflict that starts a massive bout between, you know, brothers. It's why do any brothers fight? Why do you steal a toy? You know, it's that sort of shit.
No, I was going to say it's like that. And that's why too, I know if anybody starts reading the novels, it's interesting kind of what you're touching on is like the different styles to where even within the own same legions, they're like, why are you doing it like that? Like, that's not what we were taught. Or you would actually see in the books how certain legions would have to work together because like Death Guard and Fists, like a great example.
Yep.
One's war of attrition. One is, you know, tear down the fortress. So like the two together, you wouldn't think would work together, but the two fighting styles do.
And you would think that on that level that Perturabo and Dorn would have gotten along really well.
Gotten along better, but they didn't.
But they didn't. They were like exact. They're so closely matched, which breeds exact opposites.
Yeah.
And so much of this is just, it's core to how the Space Marines work as an Imperial faction and why they also function as a traitor legion, as the Chaos Legions in modern 40K. Because you can do that. You can have an Ultramarine, you know, you can have two Ultramarine players who play completely different stories, tactics styles.
Yeah.
Styles. They have different stories. They've got different units that they take and it works. And they might even fight each other because at a certain point, they're both there for the same reason, but they're not, there's no fusion. There's no unification.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like total different styles.
And the first attempt to unify them was realistically naming Horus Warmaster, which was largely not well received for a lot of different reasons.
Yep. Majority of them wanted Sanguinius.
A lot of them wanted somebody else or wanted it for themselves. These guys are petty, arrogant, you know, essentially 19, between like 19 and 30-ish for the large part when they're discovered. Some of them, the ones that were discovered towards the end of the Great Crusade, were a couple of hundred years old. But at the beginning of the Great Crusade, like Horus and Leman Russ, the first couple that were discovered, these guys were like young, arrogant kids with a ridiculous amount of power. And they've never been challenged and they've never been knocked down a peg because they're just that powerful. That young pettiness comes through. So even though Angron, as an example, understood that Horus was the best choice for Warmaster, he resented it and wanted to beat the shit out of Horus and take the title for himself. Even though Dorne may have respected that Horus was the best choice, and Dorne did, Dorne was like, why didn't I get picked? I'm the more level-headed person. Perturabo, another person that was like, I am the best tactician. They all had, even if they publicly accepted Horus, and we mentioned the couple that didn't publicly accept him last episode, but even if they publicly accepted Horus or even liked Horus, they all kind of had the, it should have been me, with one exception, Sanguinius. Sanguinius was like, it should have been Horus, and I fully support my brother.
Yep. Believe it or not, Blood Angel players, you actually have the most loving Primarch.
The best, like kind of the only good guy Primarch. Realistically, the only good guy Primarch.
The one with the wings. The most mutated one.
Yeah, exactly. So the fall of Saren Luxor, 000.M31. Very little is known or has survived within Imperial records of this campaign. Not even the forces involved remain in record. Whether this is due to faulty record keeping or whether it was purposely expunged has been left unclear. So there's a chance that this is a campaign that was led by either the 2nd or 11th legions there's a chance that something went really bad, or it just fucking old as shit and people forgot. Not really a reason why some of these events are unrecorded. Next up is a big one, and that is the Council of Nicaea, 001.M31. This was the Great Imperial Conclave called by the Emperor to determine whether or not the use of psychic powers presented a greater benefit or a massive danger to humanity and the Imperium itself. Ultimately, in the decree absolute of the Emperor, the existence of certain psychers, like navigators and astropaths, were sanctioned but bound under tight registration rules, restrictions, and imperial law and control, while the use of unrestricted psychic powers or sorcery was officially banned. The dangers in the use of sorcery was correlated with bargaining with other powers or tapping too greatly into the warp. This is one of the few and first times that the existence of the warp and the entities that lived within it was confirmed, at least in part, by the Emperor to the Primarchs. Additionally, the Librarius departments of the Space Marine Legions were banned, and the librarians themselves, who had acted as the Legion's psychic combatants, were ordered to return to the duties of simple battle line Astartes soldiers. So, not only were they told you're no longer a librarian, and a librarian had been a role that was like, it's a command role. It's not just you're a psychic commander, like a psychic combatant, not commander, sorry. But you're in a command role. You're in a leadership role. They weren't just told you can no longer use your psychic powers. They were told you can no longer use your psychic powers and welcome to being a private. So you go from commander to private, and you're told you can't fight the entire way you were designed to fight, which is a little double shitty.
Some of the legions actually locked up their librarians.
The Imperial Fists. Yeah, all the librarians of the Imperial Fists went into seclusion on the Phalanx, and they were deep in prayer, trying to suppress their powers, trying to actively suppress their psychic powers, when a demon broke on board the Phalanx and was in the process of slaughtering everything. And the gal that we've talked about a couple of times, what's her name?
Keeler.
Oh. Euphrates Keeler, yeah. Let out a psychic scream. And it was at that point that the librarians were like, we have to drop our vows. We have to fight. And Doran actually was like, you guys You have to unleash yourselves there. We will lose if you don't join this fight.
Yep.
That's such a cool fucking scene, by the way. That entire battle, and like Loken's trying to fucking chase Keeler down, and there's this demon rampaging across the Phalanx, and like Doran is pressed into a corner and losing against the demon. That entire sequence is badass. Anyway, Magnus the Red and his Legion of the Thousand Sons would continue to bend the ruling of the Council of Nicaea as much as they could, still studying and gathering resources on such powers back on their world of Prospero. It is kind of important to point out, though, the Thousand Sons were still collecting knowledge. They were still acting as librarians, and not as librarians as in the role of librarian, but librarian as in the term, you know, somebody who protects books.
Decimal system.
Yeah, they were still gathering knowledge, but they weren't necessarily out on the field throwing fireballs. They were, by and large, still following the council. They were bending the rules as much as they could.
They weren't running around with their little familiars that would just float around and pop out of the nothingness.
That's not really a combat spell, though. That's just a little helper.
This is my little bird. It's flying along with me.
Right.
Until later, and it turns into something else.
Turns into a screamer.
Yeah.
The Council of Nicaea also is the origin of the Chaplain Edict. Again, this was ordered by the Emperor. This required every Space Marine Legion to establish a new specialized rank known as a chaplain, modeled after the practices of the Word-Bearer Legion. These chaplains were charged with ensuring that their legions remained committed to the ideals of the Imperial Truth, helping to maintain discipline, morale, and the faithful adherence to the Emperor's vision. This is another one of those cases where we see the odd two-sided nature of the Emperor and his plans. He wants them to have other faith in him, but he doesn't want them to see him as a godlike force. He has this omnipresent vision and plan for the future, but I'm not a god. Have faith, I know all of the right steps, but I'm not a god. Guys, I'm a god. but I'm not a god. Also, the word bearers had chaplains before,
yep.
and they served yep. a bit more like chaplains, like the way that you'd think a chaplain is. However, after the censure of Monarchia, their chaplains turned into these like morale style officers instead, publicly facing, inwardly facing. The chaplains were running warrior lodges and spreading religion and yada, yada, yada. But outwardly to the Imperium and to the Emperor, they were like rules lawyers.
I think too, if anyone gets a chance to read the book with this, it's really neat how the landscape's described. I think the author even mentions, like, the Emperor picked this planet because it's like a new fledgling planet, just like the new fledgling Imperium.
Yeah, Nikea is a very interesting place. It's also, you know, it's a parallel to Earth's history. There was a, I'm going to butcher this and Chalk's going to kill me, but there was a meeting between the Byzantine, not the Byzantine, but in like the 300s or 400s, there is a meeting in the Turkey-ish area, the Istanbul-ish area, that was a council that was held by the Romans to figure something out. And I feel like all of this knowledge is on the tip of my brain, and I'm probably a couple of hundred years off. There is historical precedence that this event is based on. I just don't know it enough to quote it or talk about it. Just enough to butcher it. Just enough to make some of our similar listeners scream at their podcast.
I definitely can't help you, Ryan.
Oh, yeah, you're great with history and maps.
Strongest subject.
100%. That's the reason you're here, man. If I didn't have you fact-checking my historical data and telling me about maps, we'd be lost.
Yeah, 100%.
So next up is the Chodax campaign of 001 to 007.M31. This was intended to round up and wipe out the remnants of Urlok Urg's empire, who had fled to the barren world of Chodax. This was a xenocidal campaign led by the White Scars. Warbros, Urlok Urg, not Urlok Urg, Urlok Urg, had rounded up and united a chunk of Urg's old Wa and moved to Chodax and was using the world to launch raids on nearby Imperial worlds. The campaign concluded in the early months of the Horus Heresy with the unexpected intervention of the Alpha Legion during the void battle over the planet known as the Chodax Engagement, leading to the White Scars' learning of Horus's rebellion. It was at this point that Jakatai Khan decided to return to Terra to aid the Loyalists in the oncoming defense.
It almost sounds like an insult.
Chodax.
Yeah, you fucking Chodax.
You Chodax.
I was going to say, I was wondering if you caught on to that or you were
Of course I did.
You were going to let that go.
Of course I did.
I said Chode. He was going to bring it up.
Of course. It's me.
So,
and I just want to point out to everyone how loyal of a son the Khan is. What's happening? I'm going straight back to Terra.
100%. My boy is loyal.
Yes.
The Khan, the White Scars would probably be my legion. The Khan would probably be my legion. We talked about this in a past episode, but
I just want to point out, just to all of you that listen and know a little bit about your history about these legions, straight to Terra where they were supposed to go.
Straight to Terra and straight to Dorne's side. And immediately, even though he didn't necessarily agree with some of Dorne's tactics, immediately started defending Dorne to a lot of Imperial army officers. Was like, no, this is the guy that was put in charge. You need
this
to fucking
listen.
This is the
guy put in charge. We're listening.
Yeah, buckle down and listen. It's interesting. So the Alpha Legion shows up in the sky above Chodax and this battle starts. And the Alpha Legion at this point is just doing what they're supposed to. They show up and they're helping the White Scars. And they kind of have this like micro plan of like feeling out the White Scars and figuring out where they stand. Every time we bring up the Alpha Legion, kind of try to keep in mind that nobody really knows whether or not they're good guys or bad guys. At this point, they at least seem to be on Horus's side. And they're kind of like testing the waters. They're trying to figure out, can we even talk to the Khan about this? And a signal comes in, a message comes in from one of the other rebellious, because they're not traitors yet, one of the other rebellious Primarchs. And it's accidentally intercepted by one of the Khan's ships. One of the White Scar scout ships just happens to basically be between point A and point B, and the signal goes through it. And because it passes through it, it's picked up on their equipment. and they listen to it, and it's suspect enough that when they tell Jakatai about it, that's when he's like, "Nah, we're going back to Terra. This sounds fishy. We're going back to Terra." Very, very interesting little tidbit.
Little tidbit of what happens.
So next up is the Kayvan Belt Expedition of 002-003.M31. This is another Xenocidal campaign against the orcs, this time conducted by the Blood Angels and Alpha Legion. Again, the scattered remnants of the orcs can be traced back to the Ulanor Crusade. So this is another chunk of Urlok Orgs Empire that orcs. God damn, all of these names that are just glug, glug, glugs.
Just glug, rock, 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 rock.
Yeah. Back, 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 back. Just another chunk of Urlok Urgs Empire that had scattered out. Contact is lost with the Istvan system in 003.M31. This is entirely brought up and detailed for the spooky foreshadowing. There's not a lot of detail about how or why contact was lost, but this is when it was. Next up is the Vespia incident of 003.M31. This is another one of those either expunged or forgotten and lost bits of lore. Maybe they'll explain it at some point. Maybe it's just a place that you can say your warband came from. The Luna Wolves are renamed the Sons of Horus, 003.M31. After the defeat of the orcs at Ulanor, the Emperor suggested that the Luna Wolves be renamed the Sons of Horus. At first, Horus is reluctant to accept the name change as he doesn't want to aggrandize himself. However, he eventually changes his mind after a conversation with Sanguinius, who had suggested he reconsider. After the Luna Wolves had persecuted a war against the human hybrid Xeno civilization known as the Interrex, the Luna Wolves had actually tried to not get into a war with these guys. They tried really, really hard. But essentially everything failed and the Luna Wolves had to Luna Wolf their way out of it. The Interrex was a highly advanced interstellar human empire that had settled 30 star systems by the time the Great Crusade came into contact with them. They had subjugated and then become allies with the Kinnebrak, a simian alien species. The negotiations fell apart when the Interrex accused the Luna Wolf diplomatic delegation of having broke into one of their museums. This was called the Hall of Devices, and it was located on the planet of Xenobia. Their accusation was that the Luna Wolves had broken in and stolen a weapon that was called the Kinnebrek Anathame, a weapon that had been prized by the simian race and was known to have deep connections to Chaos. The Interrex believed at this moment that the Imperium had sided with Chaos, for they knew of the ruinous powers and had collected artifacts like the Kinnebrek in order to secure them. The Interrex essentially knew and completely led everything differently. This led ultimately to the Luna Wolves violently bringing the Interrex to compliance, a conflict lit off by the treachery of Erebus. So as I kind of mentioned a second ago, the Interrex approached Chaos from the like completely opposite, diaposing theory position of the Emperor, however you want to say that. They believed that sharing the knowledge and the understanding of Chaos is the best way to protect the galaxy from the Chaos Gods. So because of that, when they had come across these things like the Kinnebrek Anathame, they studied it and secured it in a museum. They basically put it behind equivalent of like...
behind glass.
Yeah. Maximum security glass, essentially. And because of that, they knew where it was. They knew that nobody could use it. They knew that its connection to the ruinous powers was secured. And that was the way they dealt with it.
That was the weapon that was said to be able to kill perpetuals, correct?
That is the weapon. The Kinnebrek Anathame is the weapon that wounded Horus.
Ah. They're the race, too, that also believe that they had to be on the lookout for humans that would come to them in the guise of peace but dressed for war.
Yeah.
Which was why they're kind of... yeah, I think we've talked about this before. They had the planet with the musical warning.
Yep, they were the ones that did the murder spiders. The
murder spiders. They were like instead of big bulky to transform like into a space marine, their troops were like big but lean.
Yeah.
And had power armor but not quite the same power. I mean, they were almost they were a hardcore match for Horus and the Space Marines. They were like pretty close.
And it was literally one of those cases where the Luna Wolves and Horus had been invited to their palace and everything fell apart while they were there. And it's one of those like weird situations where had they had to fight their way in, they probably wouldn't have won. But since they were already in under the guise of like peace and a treaty, they were able to overcome it. And Horus felt really bad about this.
Yeah, Horus didn't like this at all.
Horus and the Luna Wolves really liked the Inter-X. The only problem that they really had with the Inter-X was the fact that the Inter-X had an alliance with the Kinnebrak, which were these like, you know, simian, like big ape, essentially, monsters. The Inter-X had essentially like centaur soldiers, biomechanical centaur soldiers was one of their forces. They had guys that were like super big and tall and power armor. And they used weapons like bows and stuff. There's not a lot of official art of them, but there's a lot of like interpretations of what they would have looked like from the novels.
It's just, it's a really cool subspecies of humans, I guess, right? That's in the novels.
It's definitely a minor Xenos species that I would love to cover in one of our minor Xenos species episodes. The Inter-X, it'd be cool to get into them a little bit more.
And in the way it's described, I remember it too, just puts you in the mindset of how powerful Primarch really is without their armor. This Horus goes to this with no armor and fights his way out basically with a butter knife.
Yeah, he gets...
slaughters everybody.
He essentially gets like a normal Astartes troop combat knife.
Yeah, so, John Wicks his way out of the planet.
Yeah.
The Mournival is there. Loken is there. I mean, Abaddon is like his heavy hitters are with him. When the shit hits the fan, Horus is, I believe, alone. Like he's the only, none of the other Luna Wolves are there with him in like a banquet hall when they accuse him of stealing the Kinnebrak Anathame, and everything escalates quickly.
Yeah.
Very, very quickly. And then, you know, the Luna Wolves are called in. They do their lightning strike. They basically destroy the majority of the planet and comply the major planet. And very quickly after that, it's very easy to take the rest of the civilization. It's Horus's primary attack. It's his spearhead attack. They destroy the planetary leadership of this civilization, and that's enough to destabilize it so that he can essentially leave the Imperial Army in charge of cleaning up. I'd love to do a full episode on the Inter-X. They're interesting. They're very interesting. Be cool if they're still out there somewhere.
Probably are.
Horus falls mortally wounded on the moon of Davin, 004.M31. Little did the Inter-X or the Lunar Wolves know, but Erebus had been the one to break into the Hall of Devices and steal the Kinnebrak Anathame. The ruinous powers had informed Erebus and Logar that if they wished to bring Horus to their side, they would need the blade in order to have that happen. Erebus, his crimes and plans going unnoticed and undiscovered, just happened to be with the Luna Wolves in Inter-X space when news reached Horus of the rebellion in the Davin system. Soon, the newly named Sons of Horus had been recalled, and Erebus shared with Horus that Eugen Temba had turned traitor. So there's a little bit of back and forth at this point. Horus is pretty sure with his conversation with Sanguinius that he's going to rename them the Sons of Horus. And most of the Mournival are kind of like, yeah, we're the Sons of Horus. And some have even started to like repaint their armor. But this entire time period is very much the, are they Luna Wolves or are they the Sons of Horus? It's the transitionary period. But just realize the Luna Wolves and the Sons of Horus are the same legion. This is just, their name is changing. Horus was furious that the man he had considered a close friend and whom he had personally named planetary governor would turn against the emperor. He led the attack on Davin's moon himself with a spearhead of 400 Sons of Horus, 3 Titans of the Legio Mortis, which included the infamous Imperator-class Titan Dies Irae, and 4,000 Imperium Army troops drawn from the Byzantine Janizars. However, the once desert terrain of Davin's moon had been transformed into a plague-ridden swamp, and the heavy tanks normally used for such an assault were rendered utterly useless. These swamps were also infested with the reanimated zombie-like corpses of the Imperial Army garrison that had been left with Tenba to secure the system. and the battle went quickly from unpleasant to downright horrifying. The opening moments of this battle, these guys are walking through this nasty, fetid swamp and wading through just this gross, you know, like not necessarily plague ridden yet, but like just this gross decaying bog. And then their machines stop working as well. Even the Titans kind of start having problems because shit's just gumming up all the workings. Their tanks stall out. Troops get out of the tanks and start walking. Imperial Army troops get out of the tanks and start walking essentially next to the Sons of Horus as they're getting closer and closer to their goal. A fog rolls in, and then the undead come out of the bog water. All of these undead Imperial Army soldiers basically come out and they start shooting, and then they start attacking by hand. And it's just this really, really horrifying scene. And like, what does an Imperator Titan do? I mean, they fire all their weapons, but you're firing weapons meant to destroy other Titans at like zombies.
Yeah, what's it going to do?
Seeking to understand the only slightly understood corruption and rebellion, Horus led an assault on Tenba's lair, which was inside the massive downed Imperial starship, the Emperor's Glory. Using their favorite tactic of lightning strikes, Horus and 200 of his Astartes warriors made it inside the hazardous wreck before part of it collapsed, cutting them off from one another and the outside. So not only were they cut off from their own reinforcements, but in the collapse, all of the warriors that make it in with him are scattered throughout the ship or killed. Loken is one of them. There's a couple of other important, often mentioned Luna Wolves / Sons of Horus that are in the ship when this happens. And they're all essentially like in ones or twos, and they don't really know how to get back to one another. It's been a while since I read the book. The outside wall comes down to the ship and the floor collapses. So the floor collapses and basically dumps them into like the bowels of the ship, and then chunks of wall come down and separate them. And they can kind of like hear each other. They kind of know that they're within a couple of rooms, but it's become like a deadly tangled maze, and they have to kind of pick their way out of it. This is totally your story, Marky. This book, this battle... I shouldn't say this book. This battle has a lot of undead zombie shit in it.
Definitely my scene.
Yeah, it's pretty gruesome.
Cut off and alone, Horus nevertheless still burned with a cold rage at the betrayal and pushed his way through the wreckage of the ship until he found his way onto its bridge. He did this just in time to see the hideously bloated and infected Nurgalite form of Eugen Tenba kill Verulam Moy, one of Horus's most esteemed captains. In the ensuing battle that followed, Horus bested and then killed Tenba, but not before he had been wounded by the Kinnebrek Anatheme, the same weapon that Erebus had stolen from the Interrex. The Kinnebrek Anatheme was an artifact sacred to Nurgle, and it poisoned Horus, bringing him low and close to death. Horus's superhuman body was unable to fight off this cursed infection. The Mournival soon after found Horus and rushed him to the Vengeful Spirit, which was in high orbit. But the apothecaries of the Son of Horus were hard-pressed to fight the disease, and eventually it was clear that the science of the Imperium had failed. It was then that Erebus put into play the next part of the plan. Speaking to the Sons of Horus Warrior Lodge of the House of Healing on Davin itself, this House of Healing was the Temple of the Serpent Lodge, a massive building that was built inside a large crater, and it was here that a 300-strong Warrior Lodge contingent of Astartes brought Horus. To be clear, Erebus planted the seed that this was a house of healing. This was not. This was just a warrior lodge. It was just another lodge. It was essentially
a chaos altar.
Yeah, a chaos altar. Yeah, it was a chaos cathedral, and it was a massive one. But at this point, none of the Astartes know what any of the chaos iconography means. There is no connection. You know, if you wanted a real world connection, this is not understanding the "don't touch this surface, it's hot" warning sign when you're a three-year-old. Like, you have no connection yet. None of that stuff is formed. No one's told you. You haven't touched a hot stove yet. You don't know what those icons mean. And that's this. To them, it's just weird backwater healing house icons. They don't see the eight-pointed star as being a problem. They don't see any of this Nurgle shit. It's not just Nurgle. I think it's Nurgle and Tzeentch. They don't see any of it as being weird. They just don't notice it for what it is because they have no point of reference. It's while he lies dying within the lodge that Erebus exposes Horus to the ruinous powers, who begin to manipulate the War Master's emotions, fears, and even the latent jealousies that he has for his father, the Emperor, and the Imperium that he controls. When Horus eventually emerged, healed and whole, the 63rd Expeditionary Force rejoiced at his return, almost none realizing that the seeds of corruption and treason had already been planted deep within his heart. This is one of the points where Loken and a couple of other guys,
there's essentially came to blows trying to prevent him going into the lodge.
Going into the lodge. Because like, there's
Luna Wolves almost fought Luna Wolves over this.
Yeah. In the apothecary's chamber, they're pretty much told he's dead. There's nothing we can do. He's gonna die. He is beyond anything within Imperial science, the Imperium science, or even the Emperor's science that can save him. And they essentially mourn his loss. And then his body is essentially stolen and taken down. And this pisses not a lot, but the remaining Terran Luna Wolves, this is like the kind of the fissure, the crack within the Luna Wolves itself, is there is a contingent that as to where they're happy that he comes out alive, they're also like, something doesn't feel right. They know. They don't know what it is, but they know it's wrong, essentially.
Yeah. Do they say like what they did to him to heal him?
No.
No.
Well, do the authors say? Yeah, the ruinous powers, essentially. Yeah. You know, Nurgle stops. Horus agrees to follow the gods as undivided, and because he agrees to follow the gods as undivided, to accept the primordial truth, in air quotes, Nurgle stops the disease.
Ah.
But as far as do the Luna Wolves know? No, the Luna Wolves have no idea. They just know that he goes in and humana, 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 new Primarch.
But like Ryan was saying, this like straight up in the novel shows the division right away. And it's not even just the Terran ones. It's like there's regular ones from
their home world.
Their home world. They're like, yeah, no. This isn't right. Like what's happening is not right. Like he's dead. Can't bring him back.
Yeah.
What are you guys doing with his body?
Yeah. And again, you know, the Council of Nicaea has already happened. So they're like, no, you're performing dark sorcery and necromancy. This is wrong. The Emperor has told us you can't do this. But at the same time, their dad is saved. It's like that internal war. And it's played out internally as like soldier to soldier has to come to grips with it. And it's played out internally as in the Legion has to come to grips with it.
Well, what I'll say is I know there's one, what is he called? The Half Herd? The captain? He's part of the Luna Wolves that leave. He's like the epitome of the whole when they decide what wolves are gonna stay, what marines have to go on the planet and die, you know, the private, you know, ad hoc squads and all that. He's picked to remain as a son of Horus. And his nickname is the Halfherd. He's just this old, grizzled, Terran. You know, I'm getting the job done. Here's my orders, Captain.
Isn't he stayed like a Luna Wolf?
Well, he became a son. They all became sons of Horus. And like, he sees what's about to happen. He's like, yeah, you know what? Fuck this. Fuck Horus. I'm out.
The first one who says, I am not a son of Horus. I am a Luna Wolf is Loken.
Yeah.
It's not long before, I mean, like the dude standing next to him is like, that's a good idea. Like, it's one of those things. It's not like, it doesn't happen over like months. It's literally within it's like the instant. Course of a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds very similar to Full Metal Alchemist. Essentially, like these two sons try to bring their mom back to life, but they don't know like the powers that they're dealing with. And instead of getting their mom back, they essentially bring back like a soulless husk of like organs and like whatever the ingredients are that make up the human body. And in doing so, it's like taboo to do that. They peer into like the void and the void takes away like their body. And it takes away the body of one brother and it takes like the arm and leg of the other as payment for trying to commit this taboo thing.
Full Metal Alchemist is one of the animes that even though I've never seen it, I know a lot of the story because of the memes. My knowledge comes from the memes, including the GIF that I looked up. Yeah, there's something that the Full Metal Alchemist world, there's something about like you can't resurrect people. You can resurrect people, but it goes horribly wrong.
Right.
The Destruction of Olympia, 004.M31.
Don't need that place anyway.
Perturabo had become embittered towards the Imperium during the course of the Great Crusade, believing that he and his Iron Warriors had been spent incorrectly. Given garrison duties or tasks of siege breakers, forever kept from the frontline battles that were filled with the glory and recognition that he believed was their due. To be fair, a lot, especially at the beginning of Perturabo's gripes, are not, I'm not getting the glory. It is literally, my sons are not getting their due. He is very worried about his legion before he's twisted and exposed to certain things. Perturabo, in a lot of ways, is like the tragic figure, like Macbeth. There is something that's a core of good in him. It's just twisted really quickly and really badly. Speaking of, a rivalry, which at first was brotherly, had grown between him and Rogel Dorn until it was a vicious, nasty wound that had grown to separate the two brothers. After his corruption to chaos, the War Master, Horus, had begun to leverage these feelings towards resentment and aiming them at the Emperor and the Imperium itself at large, deftly manipulating Perturabo in hopes of swaying his brother to his side. Then came the unexpected rebellion of Olympia. With the death of Demichos, the long-lived tyrant of Lokos, who had been the chosen imperial governor, what at first started as duplicitous and viperous politics to fill this void became outright infighting and then open insurrection. The Iron Warriors were unable to respond as they were engaged in a single-handed action to hold back a major incursion of the Hrud during the Soktronda Deep campaign, a battle that dragged on for over a standard Terran year against a foe that had always proven to cost in lives, equipment, and the general sanity of those who had survived. The Hrud are a truly alien and nightmarish race. They cause things around them to age rapidly in a weird sort of like radiation time warping effect. So if you think of like how people get radiation sickness, just being near a radioactive orphan sourced, these guys manipulate and age time around them, like equipment that's around them, people that are around them. And this is part of that like degradation of sanity. You know, Iron Warriors would be fighting these guys and like their bolters would rust in their hands as if they had aged like 900 years in a couple of seconds. Now, we've talked about the Hrud in the past, and they are definitely a race that will get more attention in the future. But if you've got a little bit of time, listeners, and you want to check them out, I would definitely Google or dig in some of the old codexes and find little passages on the Hrud. They're pretty interesting.
Wonder if they're like a race for Nurgle.
Sounds like it.
They're not. They have no connection to chaos that anybody can like determine.
It's just a trip. It's like,
at one point, the Hrud were space Skaven. They're a little different now. They've changed. But just like the Skaven use a lot of warp stuff, a lot of warp fuckery, but the Skaven aren't a chaos race. The Hrud use a lot of warp fuckery, but they're not a chaos race. The Hrud are cool. I always like it when something is introduced or talked about in Warhammer, whether or not it's fantasy or whether or not it's Warhammer 40K. There's so much of the axiom of it's either good in air quotes or the warp. And I really like it when they bring out something that's like, this is another weird thing that isn't related to either. Like the Necrons. The Necrons aren't not warp either. And they're not warp. They've got their own weird flavor. And I really like it when they play with stuff like that.
I really do wish I would have kept up reading the Horus Heresy books.
One of the interesting things about Perturabo, and I know that he's not the first choice. He's not the one that gets talked about a lot, but Perturabo was very much known for just how exacting his plans were. He was really, really good at planning and executing war.
In the novels, there's one of the novels where it deals with just the Fists and the Iron Warriors, And it has to do with I forget what they call it, the reclamation fleet that the Fists are sending to Istvaan 3 after the or Istvaan 5 after the massacre. Like, Dorne's just sending his own fleet to go make whatever traitors are still there go away. And they get trapped in the warp and all this, right? But what's really cool is Fists end up on Perturbo's flagship. And the end result, the Fists that are remaining that Perturbo doesn't kill, he hands over to Fabius Bile.
The other thing that we'll have to cover at some point, and I can't remember the name of the conflict off the top of my head, but at one point, Perturbo baits the Fists into attacking a planet, and the planet has been, it's the Iron Fists, like, monastery world, essentially. It's their it's their planet.
The cage.
Yeah. And they've made this 30-mile radius trap for the Fists, and they just...
Oh, this is when you're talking about after the heresy is, finger quotes, over, and Gilman inflicts this whole thing of splitting the chapters.
Yeah, yeah. It's right around that time.
The Dorne actually decides... So, you know, there was going to be another civil war right after the heresy, and Dorne decides to back off. He throws his entire legion at that planet to have them die in combat so he can create his smaller chapters.
That's part of the lore. That's the propaganda way of looking at it.
Oh my God, here we go, the propaganda way.
Dorne is baited onto a planet by Perturbo, and Perturbo almost kills Dorne and almost wipes out the Imperial Fists. It takes the Imperial Fists, like...
Yeah, down to make, like, 4 chapters.
Like, 2,000 or 3,000 years to recover. It's one of those events. Maybe it's only 1,000 years. It takes the Fists a long time to recover. It's a very, very bitter...
Yeah.
Neither one of them wants to give up, but Perturbo baited Dorne perfectly. It's the ultimate, my job is to make defenses and my job is to break defenses, and those guys are having an all-out war with one another.
Yep.
So, battered by the campaign and enraged by the rebellion of their homeworld, the Ninth Legion returned to Olympia. Driven past the bounds of mortal anger, Perturbo presented the people of Olympia with a choice. An act decimation, killing 1 out of every 10 in the population, or face complete extermination and eventual enslavement if they refused. The rebels refused, and Perturbo and the Iron Warriors brutally purged city after city, often overrunning and overtaking the fortifications and defenses that the Primarch had built himself. Some of the Iron Warriors refused to slaughter their own people, however, and they too were struck down and murdered by their brother Astartes. When the massacre was over, over 5 million Olympians were dead and the rest had been enslaved by the Iron Warriors. Only once the world was covered in massive burning funeral pyres did Perturbo realize what he had done. No longer were the Iron Warriors saviors of the Imperium. As the pyres cooled, the Lord of Iron knew he could never atone for such a worldwide genocide against his own people. Perturbo believed the Emperor would never forgive him for his actions. But Horus not only forgave him, but lauded his brother's thoroughness and dedication to eliminating the enemies of the Imperium. Horus swore Perturbo to never feel guilt over what he had done to Olympia, but these words would prove easier to say than accept as truth. He basically made Perturbo, like, you know, hey brother, nothing you did was wrong. The Emperor would have been proud of you. You did the right thing. Swear to me that you understand, blah, 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 blah. However, the die had been cast, and the Lord of Iron had, even if he didn't know it yet, chosen his side in the oncoming conflict. And that will bring us to a close on part 3 of the Great Crusade, and we are pretty solidly into the events that overlap a bit more into the beginning of the Horus Heresy side of the time that takes place between these two chunks of Imperial history. We did try to avoid a 4-parter. But as we kind of covered earlier, the next few events we're going to cover could be deep dives on their own, specifically the burning of Prospero and what led to the burning of Prospero.
Oh, man, that one is again, another really good, I think, book. Gives you both sides of it. I'm only trying to warn Dad. I'm only trying to do what Dad says.
Yeah. Yeah. The burning of Prospero, which is the next major event in the timeline, it very much alone could require us to like have an entire fucking episode. We're going to have to go back and talk about what Magnus found out when he decided to attempt to warn the Emperor, how the Emperor responded, why the Space Wolves reacted the way they did. There's not many events left before we hit the two Istvan atrocities, the Istvan 3 atrocity and the Drop Site Massacre. These are the events that split the rest of the Primarchs into one or the other side.
Yep.
For better or for worse.
Some for worse. For worse.
Want to get into contact with us about the show or ask us about some bit of lore you feel we missed, or maybe share your own short stories, homebrew lore, and spooky dookies? You can reach out to us by email at underthehiveofmadness@gmail.com or jimdarkgaming@gmail.com.
You can also reach us through our community on Discord. There we chat about 40K lore, the hobby, tactics, Age of Sigmar, Warhammer Fantasy Battle, creative writing, video games, role-playing, and so much more. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, or at www.underthehiveofmadness.com. Like and review us wherever you get your podcast fix. Our home is on Spotify, but you can find us on Apple, Google, Audible, Stitcher, and many more.
You can also support us through Patreon at www.patreon.com/underthehiveofmadness. Patreon members get access to video podcasts with minimal editing, so you can see our faces, follow along with what we're looking at on screen, and hear our bloopers in real time. Basically, when my tongue doesn't want to pronounce words and wants to add extra letters. All Patreon levels also get access to our quarterly painting contests. Plus, we have perks at higher levels, so go on over and check it out. Probably also important to note, with our Patreon content, we have a whole like hour of extra podcasts that only patrons get access to. We cover some stuff like our hobby progress and some of our thoughts about the current state of the game and just some other stuff that's going on. Plus, you guys can get a little bit of an insight into how we plan episodes through that. So if that's stuff that you're interested in learning about us, getting kind of a glimpse behind the Red Curtain, that's the place to go. Mama Kaz's Noodle House voted the Hive's best ramen shop 6 seasons running. Come on down and try that Liz Gizzard Bowl special. Made to burn. Oh, so good. Always one step ahead of the administratum. We are this signal that can't be stopped. 665.66 UHMR Chemrat Radio. Reminding all of you Chemrats, Hive Mice, and Sump Ghoulies to keep those dials fixed right here. Same ratty frequency for a dose of the same ratty ass attitude. Ding dong bell. The four-armed emperor is in the well. Who put them in? Little Johnny Slim. Who took them out? Little Tommy Stout. What a rotten boy was he to let that dreadful monster free. Serves him right for getting bit, for he was always just a stupid git.
So he gets a little bastard.
That was a good one.
He ain't got no soundboard for no surprise.
Oh, sorry. Surprise!